living from the answer. There's a subtle yet powerful difference between working toward a result and thinking and feeling from that result. Because when we work towards something, we embark upon an open-ended and never-ending journey. While we may identify milestones and set goals to get us closer to our accomplishment, in our mind, we're always on our way to the goal, rather than in the experience of accomplishing our goal. And this is precisely why Neville's admonition that we must enter the image of our desire and think from it is so powerful in our lives. In the ancient studies of martial arts, we see a beautiful metaphor in the physical world for precisely the way this principle works in consciousness. You've no doubt seen the demonstrations of people trained in the martial arts marrying their powers of concentration and strength into a single moment of really intense focus. In that focus, they're able to perform a feat, like breaking a concrete block or a stack of boards, which would otherwise be impossible for them to do. The principle that allows for such a demonstration is the same principle that Neville shared in his story of the young man's healing. And while there are tricks that can sometimes be used to do these amazing feats without the spiritual emphasis, when they are authentically performed, the key to success is where the martial artist places their attention. When they choose to break a concrete block, for example, the very last thing in the mind of a martial artist is the point of contact where their hand will touch the surface of that block. Just as Neville suggested in his instruction to the dying man, the key is to place our focus in the place of the completed act, the healing already accomplished, or in this case, the brick already broken. Martial artists do this by focusing their awareness on a point in space that is beyond the bottom of the block. And the only way that their hands can be at that place is if they've already passed through the space between them and that point. The fact that the space happens to be occupied by something solid, like a concrete block, becomes almost secondary. In this way, they're thinking from the point of completion, rather than how hard it may be to get to that point. They're feeling the joy of what it feels like to accomplish the act, rather than all the things that must happen before they can be successful in that act. This simple example offers a powerful analogy for precisely the way that consciousness seems to work. I experienced this principle personally when I was in my early 20s. It was during that time that my life turned away from the focus of working in a copper mill and playing in a rock band to the spiritual focus of an inner power. On the morning of my 21st birthday, I suddenly found myself unexpectedly drawn to the combination of long-distance running, yoga, meditation, and the martial arts. I passionately began to pursue all four together, and they became the rock that I would find myself clinging to in times when it seemed that my world was crumbling around me. Well, it was one day in the martial arts classroom in the dojo, before our karate class began, that I witnessed the power of a concentrated focus unlike anything I'd ever seen growing up in the heartland of northern Missouri. On that day, our instructor came in early. He walked into the room and asked us to do something very different from the practices that were familiar to us. He explained that he would seat himself in the center of the thick mat, the mat that we use to hone our skills every day, and he would close his eyes and he would go into a meditation. During his meditation, he would stretch his arms out on either side of his body with his palms open and face down. He asked us to give him a couple of minutes to anchor himself in this T-shaped position and then invited us to do anything that we could to move him from his place. Well, the number of men outnumbered the women in our class by about 2-1, and there'd always been a friendly competition between the men and the women that divided the class. On that day, however, there was no competition, there was no division, because together we all sat close to our instructor, silent, motionless, as we watched. He simply walked to the center of the mat, sat down with his legs crossed, closed his eyes, held out his arms, and he changed his breath. I remember I was fascinated, and I watched closely as his chest swelled and shrank slower and slower with each breath until eventually it was hard to tell that he was even breathing at all. And with a nod of agreement, we all moved closer. One by one, we tried to move our instructor from his place on the mat. At first, we thought this was going to be an easy exercise and only a few of us tried. As we grabbed his arms and his legs, we pushed and pulled in different directions with absolutely no success. We were amazed. We changed our strategy. We all gathered together on one side of him to use our combined weight to force him in the opposite direction, and still we could not even budge his arms or the fingers on his hands. After a few moments, he took a deep breath, he opened his eyes, and with a gentle humor that we'd come to respect, he simply asked us, "What happened? How come I'm still sitting here?" After a big laugh that eased the tension, and with that familiar gleam in his eye, he explained what had just happened and what we had just seen. "When I closed my eyes," he said, "I had a vision that was like a dream, and that dream became my reality. I visualized two mountains, one on either side of my body and myself on the ground between the two peaks." As he spoke, I immediately saw the image of his mountains in my own mind's eye, and I felt that he was somehow imbuing us with a direct experience of his vision. He went on to explain that attached to each of his arms, he saw a chain that connected him with the top of each mountain. And as long as those chains were there, he said he was connected to the mountains in a way that nothing could change. And that's what we experienced. Our instructor looked around the mat at the eyes that were riveted on each word he was sharing, and with a big grin, he concluded, "Not even a classroom of my best students could change my dream." Well, through a brief demonstration in a martial arts classroom, this beautiful man had just given each of us a direct experience of the power to redefine our relationship to our physical world. The lesson was less about reacting to what the world was showing us and more about creating our own rules for what we choose to experience. The secret here is that he was experiencing himself from the place that he was already fixed in that location, on that mat, in his imagination. In those moments, he was living from the outcome of his meditation. And until he chose to break the chains in his imagination, nothing could move him, and that is precisely what happened. In Neville's words, the way you do this is to make what he called your future dream a present fact. In a non-scientific language that sounds almost too easy to be true, Neville tells us precisely how this is done. Please don't be deceived by the simplicity of Neville's words when he suggests that all we need to do to transform our imagination into reality is to assume the feeling of our wish fulfilled. In a participatory universe of our own making, why would we expect that the power to create would be any more difficult than that? Many possibilities, one reality. Why would the way that we think and feel about our world have any effect whatsoever on the events that play out in our lives? How does simply making our future dream a present fact change the course of events that are already underway? If it looks like our world is barreling down the path toward a global war, for example, does that war really have to happen? When it looks as if our marriage is about to crumble or we're destined to live with a debilitating health condition, does the outcome of these experiences really have to happen as predicted, or is there another factor? One that's often discounted that may, in fact, play a powerful role in how we experience the things that are already set into motion. Does life follow our predictions, or does life meet our expectations? These are powerful questions. The key to living from the place where our imagination is already fulfilled and our dreams and prayers are already answered is to understand how the possibilities exist to begin with. And to do that, we need to return just briefly to the central discovery that quantum physics tells us about our world. As we mentioned earlier, quantum physics has been hugely successful in describing the behavior of things that are smaller than the atom. So successful, in fact, that a set of rules to describe what we can expect to happen in this tiny invisible world have been created. But while the rules are few and simple, they can also sound strange as they describe the things that particles can do at the subatomic level. And they tell us, for example, that the laws of physics are not universal because things behave differently at small scales than they do in our everyday world. They tell us that energy can express itself sometimes as a wave, sometimes as a particle, sometimes as both. They tell us that consciousness, the consciousness of the observer, determines how energy will behave. Well, as good as these rules are, however, it's important to remember that the equations of quantum physics do not describe the actual existence of particles. In other words, the laws can't tell us precisely where particles are and how they act once they get there. What they do is they describe the potential for the particle's existence. That is, where the particles may be and how they may behave and what their properties may be like. And all of these properties evolve and they change over time. These things are important for this reason, because we're made of the same particles that those rules are describing. So if we can understand how those particles work, then maybe we can understand greater possibilities for how we work as well. And it's here that we find a powerful key to understanding what quantum physics is really saying to us about our power in the universe. Our world, our lives, our bodies, they exist as they do because they were imagined from the world of quantum possibilities. If we want to change any of these things, we must first see them in a new way. To do so is to choose again from the soup of many quantum possibilities. Then, in our world, it seems that only one of those quantum possibilities can become what we experience as our reality. In his vision, for example, my karate instructor observed himself fixed to that mat in a place and time, and for those moments in time, he was. No one could move him. So which of the many possibilities becomes real appears to be determined by consciousness in the act of what scientists have now called observation. In other words, the object of our attention, where we place our focus, is what becomes the reality of our world, and in the context of our everyday world, the observer is us. So key number 7 reminds us of this principle, simply states that the focus of your feelings becomes the reality of your world. Clearly, our role in the universe is central to the question of why the quantum world works the way it appears to work. And this is precisely why it's first important to understand the what of the scientific observations so we can understand how we can apply them in our lives. The mystery of why we need 2 sets of rules to describe the world can be traced all the way back to an experiment that was first conducted in 1909 by British physicist Geoffrey Ingram Taylor. While the experiment is nearly a century old, its results are still the subject of controversy and uncertainty today. Since the time of the original experiment, it has been recreated, reconducted many, many times, and each time the results are identical, and each time they are just as mind-boggling. The experiment is called the double slit experiment. It involves projecting quantum particles, the stuff the universe is made of, through the openings of a barrier that has 2 small holes in it and measuring the way they are detected after they come through those holes. Now, common sense suggests that when things begin on one side of the barrier as particles, that they would travel throughout the experiment as particles and end as particles as well. The evidence, however, shows that something quite different and quite extraordinary happens somewhere between the place where the particles begin and the place where they end. Scientists have found that when an electron, for example, passes through the barrier with only one opening available, it does, in fact, act just the way we would expect an electron to act. It begins and ends its journey as a particle, and in doing so, there are no surprises. When 2 slits are used, however, the same electron does something that sounds impossible. Although it definitely begins its journey as a particle, something mysterious happens along the way. The electron passes through both slits at the same time, as only a wave of energy can do, and makes the kind of pattern on the target that only a wave of energy can make. And this is just one example of the kind of behavior that scientists simply have to call quantum weirdness. Because the only explanation here is that the second opening has somehow forced the electron to travel as if it were a wave, yet arrive at its destination just the way it began as a particle. In other words, the photon is accommodating the conditions that it is given in the world. To do so, the electron has to somehow know that the second opening exists and has become available. And this is where the role of consciousness comes in, because it's assumed that the electron can't really know anything in the truest sense of the word. The only other source of that knowing is the person watching the experiment, the observer. The conclusion here is that somehow the knowledge that the electron has two possible paths to travel through is in the mind of that observer, and that the consciousness of the observer is what determines how the electron travels. The bottom line of the experiment is this: sometimes the electrons behave just the way we would expect, and when they do, the rules for our everyday world for things that are distinct and separate seem to apply. At other times, however, the electrons surprise us and they act like waves, and when they do that, they require the quantum rules to explain why that's happened, to explain their behavior. And this is where we have the opportunity to see our world and ourselves in a new light, because it means that we're part of everything and that consciousness plays a key role in the universe.